from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is Robert Siegel, former host of NPR's All Things Considered. Great Podversations features nationally recognized writers and journalists in candid conversation about books, ideas, and these challenging times we're experiencing. Great Podversations is produced by the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. It's an honor for me to continue my long relationship with this series, which televises its forums on PBS affiliates as Great Conversations. Today, award-winning author Heather Clark speaks with literary critic and novelist Daphne Merkin about Ms. Clark's latest book, Red Comet, The Short Life and Blazing Art of Sylvia Plath. Heather Clark is the author of several books and a professor of contemporary poetry. She has been awarded several scholarly fellowships, including a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship. Daphne Merkin has written as a book critic for The New Republic, The New Yorker, and The New York Times Magazine. She's also an author of essay collections and a novel entitled Enchantment. She is a contributing editor to Tablet magazine. We hope that you enjoy this great podversation with Heather Clark and Daphne Merkin.
Hi, Heather. It's a pleasure to meet you. And I first of all wanted to say congratulations to you on a really extraordinary book, which you've correctly been getting raves about, including my own. Deb Garrison, your editor, is a good friend of mine and had been my editor at The New Yorker.
Okay.
Of a lot of book pieces, and when I wrote a movie column, and sometimes some would say too candid personal essays. And she had mentioned to me the book as it was going along, and I was deathly interested, even though I had reviewed a lot of books about Sylvia Plath. I had reviewed Her Husband, a book I particularly liked, because it was one of the first to make an argument that the marriage wasn't a completely mutually destructive relationship and that Ted Hughes wasn't to be demonized. I also had reviewed the first volume of her letters and one other book. And I asked to review the book, actually. And what really surprised me, or more than surprised me, amazed me, was that you managed to make a story that everyone thought had been told, including the details, so fresh. In fact, last night I got an email from the actress Annette Bening.
Oh my God.
Who was reading the book.
You're kidding. Oh my God.
So you have fans all over the place. And she's very smart and very literary. And she said, I didn't know Alvarez and Sylvia Plath really had an affair. I thought it was just a friendship. So you have these devotees. And I think there are things I want to ask you. And as I wrote in my review, someone commented, when I finished the book, which I carried around with me, I was visiting a sort of not doomed visit to Castine, Maine. And the only thing that made it tolerable for whatever reasons was that I was carrying around this large book with me and I would escape into it. And there was a bookseller there who, a bit of a know-it-all, I won't name her since I just said that. She has a well-known bookstore in Connecticut, one of the independents. I should never have said she was a know-it-all in case she ever listens to this. And she said to me, but who's going to read this enormous biography of Sylvia Plath? And I said, it's pretty riveting. And I guess I found myself looking forward to getting into bed and reading the next chapter or the next incident, even if I knew some of it. I thought you, one of your real accomplishments in the book for me was you managed to be, which I think is difficult for a biographer. I'm reading right now, for instance, the forthcoming biography of Philip Roth.
Blake Bailey.
Which I'm going to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had read and reviewed his biography of Richard Yates, a writer I like. But this biography, I think for many reasons, including the fact that Roth controlled a lot of it, is almost uninterpretive. You don't understand who Roth is, other than he plowed through women and orchestrated his career brilliantly. But I thought what you managed to do in a really interesting way was interpret without imprinting your stamp all over it, if you know what I mean. You could take what you were saying and go with it, or if you didn't agree, you could move on. But a question I have for you is, given that there has been so much written about Plath, what led you to think, and I had read an earlier book of yours, what led you to think, I will now write a book on Plath? I wouldn't say the daring of it, but the almost the energy that it would take to take her on, given the bookshelves. You know, when I was reading it, I also relooked at a few books since I have. I relooked at The Silent Woman by Janet Malcolm. Some of the books I thought were less impressive. What's his name? Paul Alexander, which leaves aside the whole issue I'd love to ask you about your success without in the least de-psychologizing her. You also did succeed in de-pathologizing her, that not everything was this nutty woman who managed to bake cakes and sew dresses, but in between was a mad woman who wrote furious poems. But to get back to my question before I went on, what led you to think I will write about her?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, thank you for being such an attentive reader. I know it's a long haul, and I really appreciate
a long, yeah. Very readable haul. Okay.
Yeah, good. I was so intimidated by the idea of writing a Plath biography for all the reasons you mentioned, but I just kept coming back to it. You know, after I wrote my second book on Plath and Hughes's mutual creative partnership, I just felt like I had this critical foundation, and I knew her letters were being published soon in 2017, 2018. I knew that was in the pipeline. I knew that Ted Hughes's archives could be mined more deeply, you know, than they had been. And I just had this sense, I felt this sense of, I don't know what you want to call it, anger or injustice, I guess, on her behalf, that she had almost become this cliche, that, you know, the quote unquote hysterical woman writer. And I felt like that really diminished her creative legacy. You know, her name had become so synonymous with madness and tragedy. And the brilliance and the achievement of her work was almost getting lost in that. I mean, whenever I told people, not everyone, but many people I told about Sylvia Plath and this project, you know, their first response was always about the way in which she died.
Right.
Always, you know, unless I was talking to academic colleagues or that sort of thing. But you would be shocked by how many people had that response. And to me, that was just sort of a travesty. And I guess I couldn't get it out of my head when I was thinking of a third book project. And I decided to write up a proposal and just see if anyone was interested, right? And luckily, Deb Garrison at Knopf was interested.
Right.
So, and then I just went to work. And it was truly, I loved writing this book. I mean, I really did. I didn't like proofreading the endnotes so much. You know, the final stages were really exhausting, but I enjoyed it. It never really felt like something I had to drag myself to the computer right. to do. I felt so privileged to be undertaking this work. And I don't know if I'll ever feel like that again when I write a book. Probably right. not, but I did with this one. So,
no, I totally agree with you. How many people, short of having an interest in her, associated her purely with her death? One thing I think you very much highlighted in the book that I didn't even recognize fully was her general intelligence. I mean, I knew she was obviously a gifted woman, interest in so many things, subjects, the political side of her somewhat surprised me. And that for me was somewhat new. And I thought what you did well, I mean, I knew about her, what I would call boy craziness almost.
Right, yeah.
That she had to go through a number of men, boys, to prove something. I guess her competitiveness in all arenas struck me almost as sad. She didn't let herself off. Like she could have been... She was busy sending submissions endlessly to magazines. She could have thought, okay, that's my field.
Yeah.
But every field was her field.
Right.
I'm curious to ask you, because I say it in my piece carefully, do you think she was in any, and this may be a too reductive question, I couldn't figure out how likable she was. As a woman, like she seemed, obviously she wasn't going to react well to Asya Wevel, who I read that biography about. And I think the true cautionary tale is, in terms of Ted Hughes, was Asya Wevel, not Sylvia Plath. But that sort of horrid Doris Lessing response,
yeah,
which seemed... Like once in a while you mention how she's gushing.
Yes.
And then at other times she seems haughty. She seems such a mixture of needy and sort of pulled back.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she could, I think she would suss out situations and try to react to the situation where she found herself. And she could be very chameleon-like. It's interesting, a lot of the American girlfriends from the Smith era who I interviewed, most of them had extremely positive memories of her.
And of her.
She was fun. She was always laughing. She was this perfect vision of health in her Bermuda shorts. And she right. was always tan, and, you know, with a tennis right. racket in her hand. And they all had these wonderful memories of her. And then I think things changed with the British, a lot of the British women that she met. And they sort of remembered her with a harder edge. And yes, the Doris Lessing response of, well, that's, in a way, that's a different Plath too, isn't it? Because she was so American, quote unquote, so American, so gushy. And, you know, one of her friends in Britain said that when she was in a group, she gushed too much. And he asked her once, he said, why do you gush like this? Because when it's just you and me, you're so cerebral and we can talk philosophy for hours. And she had said something along the lines of, well, it's my insecurity and
right.
I kind of fall into this American mode. And
mode.
Yeah. So it did seem reactive. I was surprised too by the extremities of responses she inspired in others.
Having met Doris Lessing once, I have to say, I found her infinitely cold.
Hmm.
So it didn't totally surprise me. And didn't Merwin's wife yes. write a very negative?
Yes, she did.
I didn't like she.
Yeah.
She also, in my opinion, as a woman,
mm-hmm.
inspired envy.
Yes, I think so.
That there must have been envy about her having nabbed Ted Hughes.
Oh, certainly.
I wondered a lot about the relationship with a psychiatrist.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And which you touch on very well. I thought you could have.
Thank you. Yeah.
Gone all over the place like the psychiatrist. But as someone who's very interested in that subject and think therapists and analysts can have extraordinary power, she certainly had a lot of power over Sylvia Plath, especially about the mother.
Absolutely.
Who becomes completely demonized.
Yeah.
And I thought you, what I liked so much was the even-handedness. I thought over the years, people took such stands on Sylvia Plath. The mother was a horror. Ted Hughes was a horror. Sylvia Plath was a horror or a victim or a... And you sort of gave it a larger framing in which life got in a little bit. It's funny because I was even worried because I just written about, reviewed your book. I just finished a piece. I didn't just finish it. It was held for a while and it took me forever. I wrote a piece for the New York Review about four books about women. Like, I don't know if you heard of this book, The Equivalence.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know Maggie. Yeah.
And another book about Virginia Woolf and a book called, I adored it. It was called The Lost Girls. It was a book around the women at Horizon.
Oh, okay.
Cyril Connolly's magazine.
Oh, wow.
And one more book, Square Haunting.
Square Haunting. Yeah, I loved that. I loved Square Haunting, too.
Me,
yeah,
too. I thought it was very, very well done.
Yeah.
On a thin thread.
Yes.
And I quote Sylvia Plath because the piece is about creative ambition versus motherhood.
That's a big subject.
Which I thought Plath, partly because she had a certain capaciousness, did not see as a problem. I quote her saying, I don't know in the end what kind of mother she was. Was she a, she seemed certainly efficient.
Yeah, she was, that's the word that comes to mind first, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I would have these meta moments where I'm a mother with young children trying to find time to write about a mother with young children who was trying to find time to write. And so that was, I feel like that was one of the things I understood.
Well, one part of it was I thought Ted Hughes was very helpful.
He was. Yeah. Which I think surprises a lot of people. But he really was. I mean, for that time, he was a progressive dad.
I also wondered, you have some quote or someone says when she visits her late, I don't know how affectionate she was.
Yeah.
There seemed sort of a kind of briskness. How true that was.
Almost like a Germanic approach to child rearing as opposed to a more rambunctious American approach. Yes, certain friends mention that.
Yes.
Yeah.
What do you think of the whole feminist borrowing of her as a victim or a model or whatever's done? Both.
Yeah, I think it's complicated because, you know, obviously she died before second wave feminism became a mainstream idea. So there is this co-opting of her, right? And that's what upset Ted Hughes so much. But on the other hand, I think she was angered about the double standard and she did believe in equality of opportunity for men and women. So, and she was a trailblazer and she wanted to become a great writer. But she also had she held on to these ideas that I think feminists wouldn't really recognized. She called her female Cambridge professors grotesques and really mocked them. And she had,
I know,
this idea of being a career woman was horrible. But I think that her brand of feminism, it was this anger that she had at being forced to choose between a career and a family because she did want both. She did want to have it all. And so for me, that's her feminism, was not wanting to choose and not being willing to give one up for the other and trying to do both. So it's complicated.
It is.
Yeah.
Don't you think, or this may be just my response to it, it was a little bit permeated still by 50s notions of what made you feminine. And I think the whole notion of how you looked was a big issue to her. Thus, these Cambridge women dons were hideous to her. I think all along that issue of being attractive, also because she was married to a man with such an aura of glamour, and she saw herself as not a match for him on that level. A big question that I wouldn't ask most people, but I certainly would ask you, do you think she meant to commit suicide?
Yes, I do.
You do?
I do. And I know there are different theories about that. I think that she was terrified of going back into an institution. And this time it wasn't going to be McLean. And it wasn't going to be a limousine picking her up. Mrs. Prouty wasn't going to be paying. And so the thought of that, and she used this word Dickensian a lot, right? Going into this English public, which she might have thought of as a Dickensian asylum. I think that terrified her, and there might be more electroshock therapy. There might be more male doctors that she didn't have a relationship with. And so, I mean, who knows, right? At the end of the day, but I at least wanted to put that out there as, you know, in her last letter to Ruth Boischer, which now we have, right? Because the letters were recently published. This letter came to light in, I think it was 2018. Her last letter, she talks about her fear of mental hospitals. She uses the word, and lobotomies. She uses the word lobotomies. And she talks about her madness encroaching again. And so I think she was, terrified of, quote unquote, the cures for depression at that point. So again, I just wanted people to consider that, I guess.
No, I thought it was very well. First of all, I agree with you. I don't think it was like a call for help and in the morning, the woman, would arrive.
The nurse and all of that, yeah.
I also think the break with Hughes humiliated her, certainly in London, where she felt anyway not so taken in by people. And according to those last letters, he certainly affirmed her sexuality, which was a big part of her.
Yeah. Yeah, huge part. Huge.
Big.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that seemed to me, in some ways, she seemed so, I was going to say, I hate the phrase she owned. It's not one I use, but I'll use it anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
She owned large parts of herself.
She did.
And large parts of herself were sort of lost to her. I never thought when I was, there were things I could have gone on. This editor, Bob Gottlieb, said to me, why didn't you just write a much longer review? But as it was, I went way over what they said.
Yeah, it was a long review. I really appreciated that.
I said to them, you know, this is an important book. You either give it space or treat it as yet another. So I wrote longer even than the space they gave me, and I was surprised they kept it. Since I've had my own very difficult relationship with my mother, who's now dead, and wrote a whole novel about it called Enchantment, meant ironically, and have continued to write about her, and do suffer from a lot of depression. I wrote a memoir about depression. Her relationship with her mother, her need to present a front to her mother.
Always, yeah.
Struck me as almost astonishing that she couldn't let the mother see how depressed she was.
Yeah. Yeah. There
was, like, what was she?
I think there was just such a stigma at that time. And I remember I interviewed one of her neighbors, and his mother had driven Sylvia and her mother Aurelia to the outpatient shock therapy sessions at the first asylum she was in, Valley Head. And he said, you don't understand that how heavy the stigma was at this time. It brought shame not just to a household, but to an entire neighborhood, he said.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, oh my God, you know, and I feel like these women didn't have the language to talk about mental illness to each other. They didn't have the language. And Aurelia would say, well, but you're so brilliant and your grades are so wonderful and you won all these prizes and you're getting your stories published. And then Sylvia sees that as more pressure to succeed. You know, it's this horrible spiral in a sense.
Right. And Aurelia had a need to pretty things up anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, she did. And I think, you know, the Germanic work ethic, and they come from a family of Germanic immigrants, and that was, success was important. And Sylvia said, you know, I always give mother the gay side, right, in her letters.
Right.
That was the phrase she used, the gay side. And of course, we get a different story in her journal. But it just struck me as sad, really tragic, you know, the sense of misunderstanding.
Yes.
On both sides, in this arms race they had to kind of cheer each other up. And of course, Aurelia suffered from ulcers. And Plath had lost one parent. And, you know, I do wonder if some of that forced cheerfulness in the letters was due to this sense that, oh, I can't worry mother more.
Because I know.
She was in and out of the, Aurelia was in and out of the hospital for stomach surgeries, like for years.
Having written a memoir about depression, I still think there's quite a stigma, no matter how much it's out there. And the other thing I was going to say, I was fascinated by Otto's mother.
Yes.
Which made me think, I once wrote an op-ed for the Times, we're so bicameral about this. Is it nature? Is it nurture? When, of course, it's when Sylvia's son, Nicholas, committed suicide. I remember thinking there's usually some genetic component. It doesn't come wholly out of nowhere.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
And what do you think is her hold? I don't know how strong it is now. You certainly have helped revive it, I hope. I was reading a lot of her poems because of you. I always loved... There are two lines I loved. I think one is, and the villagers don't even like you.
Oh, right. And daddy. Yeah.
And I also love the applicant.
Yeah. It can sew. It can cook. It can talk. Yeah. That send up of marriage.
Yeah. I was surprised, except of the, which I read more of in the, what do they call that Bunting Institute book?
Oh, The Equivalence.
Yeah. That in some ways, I don't know if it was competition, that she wasn't friendlier with Anne Sexton.
Yeah.
Who seemed partly a kindred spirit, although different circumstances, but some similar impulses.
Yeah. I think that those two women, people sort of lump them together, right? Because they're both from Wellesley. They both suffered from mental illness. They both died by suicide. They're both these famous American poets, but they were so different. I mean, Sexton was really flamboyant and had a lot of substance abuse issues. And Sylvia was like, she had a very serious Germanic temperament and she got stuff done. And I don't think she had substance abuse issues. A lot of people have asked me that. And she liked her pint, you know, her sherry or this and that, but no, I mean, not to the extent that Sexton did. But,
no, certainly not.
But I think we learned so much from Sexton in Robert Lowell's creative writing class when she read all of those poems about like the double image and about being institutionalized and suffering from depression. And all of a sudden, Sylvia starts to write about those experiences in her life. And because, you know, Lowell and Sexton had kind of given her permission to do that in that class.
No, it's so interesting the way she goes from those formal poems to those candid, more loose. Well, there's always a sort of tensile pull in her work, more than with Sexton. But I think you bring across the tragedy of the whole thing in a way that is almost renewedly, for me, experienced. Not, I guess, partly did it have to be, which one always asks about, I don't know what would have made it so different. You know, had one thing gone differently, I don't know, like had the guy downstairs who she asked for money, I don't think had he been nicer. Didn't he say that he thought she went into a psychotic state?
Yeah, that night.
That she stared.
Yeah, she stared at the light in the hallway. And yeah.
I guess I wondered why they didn't move more quickly.
Yeah.
The doctor to intervene.
Yeah, he had a lot of regrets about that. And I read through his file in an archive that was recently opened, the Harriet Rosenstein archive. And yeah, he felt a lot of guilt about that he wished he had moved more quickly, but he thought that when she was home with her children, that she would never attempt anything. He thought that was sort of that her children would keep her safe in a sense. They were like this guardrail, and he just never imagined.
I've always kind of resisted the notion that, well, if you're a mother and you have children, you're not going to commit suicide. Because was she ever like blamed on that level? Well, you have two children. How could you commit suicide?
Yeah, a lot of people mention that to me too when I say, oh, I'm writing a biography of Sylvia Plath. That's something that has kind of stuck in the popular imagination as well. This sense that how could she have done that? I mean, I've met people who refuse to read her work because they can't get over what she did to her children. And I remember reading an article, I think it was by Claire Dittmer.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her last name. Right. And she mentioned this and how our culture sort of, she called Plath the culture's ultimate art monster for abandoning her children. And she wasn't making that judgment. She was just commenting that Plath has been, you know, sort of.
But she would be I use the term art monster in my New York Review of Books. She would be an art monster if she abandoned her children to write.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't win. Yeah, exactly.
Which Doris Lessing did.
Yeah.
By the way.
I'm actually working on a book about the Boston years of Plath, Sexton, Adrian Rich, and Maxine Kuman for Knopf. And it came out of my Boston chapter in the Plath biography. And I wrote a lot more. And Deb kept sort of saying, save for another book, you know.
Right.
Because I wrote the manuscript was much longer even than what you got. So
right.
Thank God Deb helped me get it down into
right.
We wanted it under 1,000 pages, right? Without notes. So
right.
I think we did manage that just under. But right. No, I'm really excited to kind of tell that story of the 50s and 60s in Boston and the relationships between these four women
Those
poets.
Women.
Yeah.
Anyway, Heather, I love talking to you.
Likewise.
Congratulations again on the book.
Thank you.
Which I just want to say is mesmerizing.
Thank you so much. That really means a lot to hear from you.
At its length. And I will remember forever. So thank you. I love talking to you. And it's the kind of book that a critic wishes for and rarely gets.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please visit KentuckyAuthorForum.com for more information and for show notes on today's podcast. And please take a minute to rate and review Great Podversations in your podcast app. Great Podversations is distributed by Louisville Public Media. It's a production of the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. Mary Moss Greenbaum, producer. Evie Clare, associate producer. And Leslie Sissel, consultant. Great Podversations is supported by Bittner's, Brown-Forman Foundation, the Geans Foundation, James Graham Brown Foundation, and LDG Development. We hope you enjoyed this great podversation. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to your joining me for the next great podversation.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.